Children International is working to end child poverty around the world by giving kids access to a safe place, a team, and a path out of poverty by focusing on health, education, empowerment, and employment. Together with people like you, we're more than a nonprofit. We're a powerful force for change. Learn more at children.org.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal. In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Becky Bond, Zach Exley, former senior advisors to the Bernie Sanders campaign, and their book, and authors, I should say, of Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. Also on the program today, as we flee the office for Thanksgiving break, a song from Jimmy Reefer Cake. It's a nonpartisan song. Doesn't take any electoral, political, positions. So I don't want to. There's a little sensitivity to that right now. Folks, right now I am headed to, probably as you listen to this, I'm in the car with some screaming kids. Probably a screaming wife. She's probably screaming at me too. Everybody's screaming at me. Driving to the... it wasn't actually the place of my birth, but it was where I was raised to celebrate Thanksgiving. I'm really debating whether or not I should talk about the imminent conflict, but I don't think I should. I'm debating about this. There's just somebody, let me just put it this way, okay? I'm not going to name names. Kelly's shaking her head. I'm not going to name any names. Let's make this hypothetical. Okay? This is totally hypothetical. Hypothetically, let's say you got an email from somebody, person A, who was forwarding something from somebody else. And that somebody else had a meme about, if you protest, do it for human rights. If you protest about a president, you're just crying. But they forwarded this, but they left whose email it was. And so, hypothetically, what I would do in that hypothetical is I would write back to that person, I got news for you. This guy is he's got neo-Nazis in his cabinet, or he's got anti-Semitists and white nationalists in his cabinet. He's being praised by neo-Nazis. In this hypothetical, I have a daughter, and I think it's perfectly rational to be protesting this, because at least then I can turn to my daughter and say, "Hey, you know how we told you not to say certain things, and how you should have respect for all people, regardless of gender, regardless of race, regardless of where they've come from, that there should be some, at least some sophistication in discourse. Like, you shouldn't, like, reference your penis size as an attribute in politics. All those things that we have taught you for your entire life, if you were hypothetically alive, and I was hypothetically saying this to you. And then she sees that they're being rewarded, because kids look at, like, the presidency like it's like a superhero, even at that age. Like, I think it's actually helpful for me to be able to say those people are protesting, because not everybody subscribes to that notion. And hypothetically speaking, if that person who had sent the meme was going to be at Thanksgiving, maybe hypothetically I would have said, like, and you could tell, maybe that hypothetical person will have the opportunity to explain to my hypothetical daughter, just, you know, why people shouldn't be protesting something like that. Okay, so let's say I was to respond that way. And then by hook or crook, that person who was not really involved in this at all, I just forwarded something to that other person, saw my reply. Just by hook or crook. Okay? And they wrote back. And there was, like, the dripping conservative aggrievement. People should be allowed to have their own opinions, which is ironic, right? Because criticizing people for protesting. People should be allowed to have their own opinions. And then tells a story about a Russian dissident pulled out of their house at 3 a.m. because their politics were wrong. 70 years later, that person's kid comes to America and celebrates America. And so imagine in this hypothetical how I would respond to that email. I would get really angry and be like, you got to be effing kidding me. I sent an email. I didn't pull anybody out of their house. But then I calmed down. I calmed down, and in this hypothetical, totally hypothetical situation, I send an apology. I'm sorry. I apologize for my tone. Wasn't something that you should have been dragged into in the first place. Maybe if that original person had any type of savvy, they would have stripped your name from that email, or maybe they'd take ownership of the sentiment instead of hiding behind you. But again, I apologize, which is what I did, hypothetically. But then this person writes back. Oh, and hypothetically, what I would have said would be like, oh, I apologize for the tone, blah, blah, but, you know, emotions are running high around these parts, I think would hypothetically the way I would be phrasing it. And then the person writes back, hypothetically, well, we shouldn't let rationality get in the way. We shouldn't let our emotions get in the way of rationality, particularly for those of us who are allegedly educated. This is how you respond to an apology. And so, hypothetically, in that situation, what I would do would be like, oh, okay, well, I thought we were done after I apologized for my tone, but apparently you do want to litigate this. And then at that point is when I would express, I don't think there's an equivalence between responding to an email and getting pulled out of your home in terms of, like, silencing your opinion. But need I remind you, your original point was these people, they're just whining because they're protesting.
There's a lot of whiny Russian dissidents too.
Right. And I said, I also think it's perfectly rational to protest this person. And I think you'll also find the most educated people in our society are the ones who are the most upset. And then, hypothetically, can you imagine this person would write back and say, oh, I wasn't talking, I was talking in general. if you could imagine something like that, ladies and gentlemen. It's almost impossible for me to imagine it. Fortunately, you don't always need an imagination. Sometimes more imaginative people come up with stories for you. Like secrets, crimes, and audio tape. It's an audio drama told week after week. Feature stories about crime, love, mystery, or conspiracy with actors you know and love. Some are dramas, some are comedies. Some are dark comedies. Okay, the one I got to say, the one I listened to most recently that I really enjoyed was Air Force One, where it is a, what would you call it, historical fiction, right, of what it was like on Air Force One as they're flying back from Dallas after the assassination of JFK.
Timely. It's November 22nd today.
Oh, my God. Impossible. Impossible, Matt. All right. Well, there you have it. So this is actually November 23rd, smart guy. But, yes, it's timely. It's interesting. It's fascinating to look at, to look back and imagine how these people, and I have to say, for me, you know, I do another radio show with Bobby Kennedy, and I know when he tells these stories, they're fascinating to me. So check that one out. You can subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, wherever you listen to podcasts, but that way you don't miss out on a single episode. So make sure you subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It doesn't matter. New episodes drop every Tuesday. You know, it's like your favorite TV, your drama, or comedy, but only sound and your imagination. And, of course, the imagination people wrote the stories. Make sure you don't miss a single episode. Subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, folks, let's listen to Jimmy Reefer Cake's song. It's just, how long is it? I know that people are a little touchy about it, but Jimmy wrote a very sweet song for the holidays.
It's a minute and a half.
And, you know, yesterday we had Janine on. We talked about how you handle dealing with it. I think this is as good a way as any to deal with any conflicts going on. And, you know, if I wasn't, maybe I'll try and sneak off and get inebriated pre-Thanksgiving, but we'll see. Here's Jimmy Reefer Cake on his prescription. What's the name of the song?
A Reefer Cake Thanksgiving song.
Well, there you go.
This Thanksgiving, I hope you don't dine alone, right? And when you head to Grandma's house, take yourself a big fat J-bone. And this time when you head outside, please don't do it alone. I said, this Thanksgiving, I beg you to get your grandma stoned. This Thanksgiving, you can count on the dinner being praised. This Thanksgiving, I bet you your grandma will be blazed. Breaking down the barriers is what Thanksgiving is for. But the hypocrites can't stand that, like I've always said before. Grandma and Uncle Bob are stoned out of their friggin' heads. Cousin Trouble's using reefer oil like cracker spread. As long as no one's driving home soon, none of this is wrong. Gather round now as we sing a Reefer Cake Thanksgiving song. I said, gather round now as we sing a Reefer Cake Thanksgiving song.
That was nice. That was nice. I like that because it was much, it was like, it captured the spirit. What's going on? I can't hear me. Can't hear my machine. Give him a little applause. There you go. Jimmy, very nice. Coming back strong. Everybody should get completely wasted before they get to, but not drunk. I think the point is you get high, it's a little bit more low key. I don't know if it's a good idea. I have a feeling if I got drunk before I went to Thanksgiving, there would be a real, real mess. A real mess. Here's the good news about this holiday season that's coming up, though, for me personally. Not just that I'll go and see my in-laws, and that's where I will get drunk. I will get really drunk. Drunk enough that I can't even open my mouth because I don't want to get into a fight. But this year, unlike most years, where holiday shopping is virtually impossible for me. Thanks to MVMT, Movement Watches, all that gift-giving anxiety can disappear with a press of a button. These watches make the perfect purchase for just about anyone in your life. And remember, they start only at $95. Now, I know you've heard me talk about the MVMT, the Movement Watch that I got Nikki. She loves it. Fortunately, she doesn't listen to the show. She didn't realize how inexpensive it was. She thinks it's like a $400, $500 watch. But it was a beautiful watch. It was the $125 one, the silver, I can't remember, the silver sky or something like that. But it's a beautiful watch. This holiday shopping season is here. And with MVMT, you can skip the crowds and standing in crazy lines at the mall and find a gift they'll love at prices that beat the department stores. Movement watches start at just $95. At a department store, you're looking at a $400 or $500 for this watch. They figured out by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and they cut out the retail markup, providing the best price possible. Classic design, quality construction, styled minimalism. Over 500,000 watches sold in over 160 countries. Here's the best part, folks. You can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmtwatches.com/majority. mvmtwatches.com/majority. Watches have a really clean design. Nikki loves hers. I'm going to get her a second one. Because that's the way I roll. If I find something that works, why fix it? Go to mvmtwatches.com/majority. Join the movement. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Zach Exley and Becky Bond, there'll be no show tomorrow. It's Thanksgiving. And on Friday, we will... We have a pre-recorded show, a couple of interviews I did from Ring of Fire that I know you'll like. We'll be right back with Becky and Zach. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to both welcome back for one person and have on the program for the first time Becky Bond and Zach Exley. They are the authors of Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. Both of them served as senior advisors on Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. Welcome to the program, Becky and Zach.
Oh, it's great to be here.
All right, let's start with, I mean, you know, when we booked this interview, I think we were anticipating, or at the very least, hoping for a different outcome. And I want to circle back to that aspect as to, has anything changed from what you prescribe based upon the outcome of this election? And maybe we can talk about maybe different strategies. But first, I want to talk about where... what this came out of this book, Zach? At what point did you and Becky say we've got to write this?
Well, I actually, it did not occur to me to write it because I knew that I would actually not get anything like this done. So, and Becky had the perfect strategy for getting it done. And so we holed up in a cabin and we just banged it out. And so, you know, I think our real impulse to write this, was, you know, to make sure that what happened on our little fringe of the campaign, because, we weren't the Bernie campaign. We weren't the Bernie organizing campaign. We were this distributed organizing team is what we came to be called. And, we started with a couple of people, Claire Sandberg and myself, and then Becky joined us. And we were able to hire a few more people. It was always a very small team. And our job was to organize people in all of the states where there was no field staff on the ground. And over time, field staff did come into some of those states, and then we wound up working with them, and they kind of, took over the show at that point. And we knew that was going to happen, and we had this weird little team that was trying to, for once, make this huge mass of volunteers in an insurgent presidential campaign, to actually make them really effective at turning out votes. And our main lever to do that with them was by building a phone banking system, which Becky really was the one who, enabled us to build that. And we learned a lot. It was the first time that something on this scale happened, in non-staffed states, on this scale of organizing and, in a presidential campaign and, maybe in any kind of a focused, staffed campaign. And we just wanted to make sure that the lessons kind of got written down and got out there. And, there was so much great innovation on the Obama campaign in 2008, but all those people went into the White House and were not able to pause and write. So, the one thing we had going for us after Bernie lost the nomination was we, had the luxury of sitting down and writing this stuff up.
Yeah, so, I mean, and actually, part of the story was someone who's been involved in progressive politics for or progressive activism and social change movements for a long time, Allison Barlow. And she's someone who has been involved in the progressive foundation world. And she sat me down right before the New York primary, and she said, Becky, there are so many social justice groups, and a lot of them, don't have a lot of resources, and they really need to learn some of the powerful organizing lessons that you guys are learning on the Bernie campaign. Can you write down some of the lessons so that we can share them with these social justice groups? And she really said it was really important to do this now, because there are so many big urgent challenges. And so, it was really from her making it clear that we needed to do it. And I thought, yeah, we need to, instead of having people have to hire consultants from the Bernie campaign and only groups that can pay can, sort of learn a lot of the things that we learned, let's put it in a book and then we can share it with everyone. Not just organizations, but some of the super volunteers who organize their own city, and give them a reference book so that they can actually keep doing this work.
So, all right. So to be clear, basically you guys were the, we called you on a military campaign. You'd be the irregulars essentially. Right.
And, yes.
Tell us specifically, what is distributed organizing?
So distributed organizing, and on a lot of campaigns, this is called the digital organizing department. Distributed organizing is how we use technology to get people to do actual, real, valuable work, no matter where they are in terms of geography and no matter what time, they have available to work. We basically take a central plan and we distribute the work to people all over the country, but they're all working towards the same goal.
Now, I mean, how does that work, Zach, on the context of a campaign? I mean, what is it? Are you just encouraging? Is it all just phone banking? I mean, how did people from your, slice of this campaign, how did they contact, what did they do once they were organized,
Well, that's the thing. So when Claire and I first joined the campaign and kind of got these 46 states, at the time, it was 46 states that were not staffed. And we literally had hundreds of thousands of people that had signed up to volunteer and that were really angry because we were not putting them to work. And I mean, we got you know, really hostile phone calls. I mean, most people were very understanding, but understandably, we got, you know, very, very hostile people reaching out to us sometimes. And we totally respected that. And we felt like we were letting them down every day. And so we were scrambling to try to, you know, give people a direction to go in. But the interesting thing was that, you know, the thing that helps win elections is voter contact, is talking to other voters. And we, unfortunately, we didn't have access for a while to the kinds of tools that help voters do voter contact or help volunteers do voter contact in a systematic way. Like, we did not have, you know, the voter activation network, the VAN, which is this, you know, tool that lets people go knock on their neighbor's doors and record the results and all that stuff. We just didn't have that. We weren't allowed to roll that out to the volunteers. And so it was when finally when Becky joined us. Well, no, don't get me wrong. We gave people all kinds of stuff to do, but they knew they weren't, you know, we said go out and recruit volunteers, you know, hold leafleting events, hold flyering events and, you know, discussions and, you know, bands for Bernie for the purpose of signing up volunteers. But people knew that, you know, they could have been doing more. So it wasn't until Becky joined us, you know, about a month later or so, and she had this experience from the Credo Super PAC, where they really, you know, empowered these volunteer-led campaigns all over America in many different races at the same time to do voter contact. And their main tool also was phone banking. So she really knew the technology and, you know, knew that this could work. And, you know, and we built a team, you know, she built a team around herself to actually implement it on this ridiculous scale.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically just the idea that, you know, the most powerful way that you can organize to move voters to the polls is for a volunteer to talk to them. And it could be their doorstep and it could be on the phone. We did a lot of this by text message also. So what we were really trying to do was build a giant voter contact machine that volunteers could be part of no matter where they lived. Because we wanted to give everybody something to do that could materially help Bernie win the contests, especially the early ones.
Okay, so you guys have outlined 22 rules. What, Becky? Give me your what you think is the most important one.
Hey, wait. Actually, can I back up for a second though?
Sure.
And I just want to add something to what we're talking about because it's I think goes to an important place. Is that what wound up happening? You know, as we got closer and closer to Iowa, and then we got into those, you know, those early states. Was we had this national voter contact capacity that was really huge. And we had the capacity to actually call every voter on the Nevada voter file list. You know, every voter that we had a phone number for, we could call every day. We actually had that big of a capacity at, you know, when we actually got up to Nevada. You know, just imagine if we, so this is why, you know, we wanted to write this stuff down and make sure that future campaigns understand this. There are so many people that are desperate to get involved and make a difference. And we only scratched the surface of the capacity that was out there to organize because, you know, we got started so late,
right?
You know, Bernie kind of, you know, announced that he was running, you know, not incredibly late, but later than he could have, and with no infrastructure. You know, there was almost nothing, you know, on his campaign when he announced. So it took a long time, you know, to, you know, we were only really just starting to be able to grow quickly when we got close to Iowa. So that was a real shame. If we could have kept, you know, if we had had another 6 months, we would have had enough people mobilized and organizing and making calls to, you know, perhaps even call a really huge chunk of the voters, like a very significant slice of the voters in all of the Super Tuesday states, for example. So,
well, let me ask you, you bring that up because, I mean, yeah. When I talk about why I think Bernie Sanders didn't win, for me, you know, and nobody knows, these are all, you know, everybody's just sort of has an opinion on this. But for me, I think 6 months is really the first answer I have. Like, I mean, if Bernie Sanders had gotten into the race, let's say 9 months before he did, with a determination that and a belief that, I mean, I don't even think he would have needed it when he got in to believe that he could have won, because I think he would have come to that realization in the same amount of time. It just would have been 9 months earlier. Let me ask you, you know, I don't know how fair of a question this is, but I mean, if you had two guys had to pick one thing that would have was the but for in terms of Sanders, would simply time have been the difference?
You know, we might have different answers on this, but I think that would have been one thing. Yeah, I think that would have made all the difference. And notice that we're blaming, factors internal to our campaign, you know, and not, factors.
We will get to that. We will get to that. Yes.
Things that we could not control.
Well,
outside of our campaign. But no, that would have made a huge difference. And then, of course, you know, all the little errors that, you know, that we ourselves, you know, personally made in execution, you know, you want to go back and do all those things
right.
over. You know, there's so many decisions that.
But there's always a 10% contingency built into every project you do, right? I mean, you always are going to mess up a certain amount. So it's really and I think that's true of any endeavor. Becky, what about from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if we had started earlier, that would have helped a lot. And I also think, you know, it took us a while to learn some of the lessons that are in the book. And we knew that we had to build a campaign from volunteers, and we knew we could trust them to do big things. But I don't think we really, in the beginning, we really got it. So, for example, you know, we encouraged volunteers to organize phone banks, you know, in the later states to call into the early states like Iowa and Nevada. But, you know, what we didn't do is we didn't empower them in the fall to start canvassing their own neighborhoods, because they would have made the calls into the early states, and they also would have been starting the canvassing and working on the voter list where they lived. And we didn't, we told them to wait, that they had to wait, and that we couldn't help them do that so early that their turn would come. And, you know, I think in some parts we worried that if they were organizing in their states, we wouldn't have enough people that were organizing to help us win the crucial early contests. But in retrospect, I think they would have done all of it. And basically, you know,
It would have enhanced both of their jobs.
If
you're going door to door, you're getting a sense of what the arguments or the appeals you're going to make on the phone and vice versa.
Yeah. And you're getting better at it and capacity is growing. But, you know, what we learned was that people are just waiting to be asked to do something big if the reward is going to be that you're going to win something truly big. And so we did ask people to do big things, but I think we could have asked them to do even bigger things. And, you know, people can't canvass effectively without being able to access and then contribute to the central voter file for the campaign. And that was something the volunteers could not do without us making it a priority. And so if we could do it again, you know, we would give access to the voter file, the campaign voter file, to the volunteers in the states from the very beginning.
You know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, when I hear that, you know, like one of the things that I think my sense is about, you know, the idea of being able to give the volunteers more work and in many respects more responsibility too. The thing that strikes me is one of your lessons. I'm going to pick one of them out because is the tyranny of the annoying is because the concern I think that broadly speaking these endeavors have, particularly ones that are sort of mixed paid and volunteer, is that the volunteers like. It's going to get out of control. Like if something's going to spin out of control because there's going to be, or not so much just sort of like iron clench control, but just that people are going to go, you know, sort of like hog wild or whatnot, or people are going to derail something. And so tell us about the tyranny of the annoying, because on some level, like you're both willing to give a more responsibility than I think people generally feel comfortable doing in this context. But at the same time, you're also willing to sort of pull the plug and tell people you got to move on.
Well, the key, though, is, you know, we gave volunteers responsibility. The key is that we gave volunteers as much responsibility as we could, but that went along with a structure and accountability. And so people had roles. They knew what, you know, when it was working and, you know, when we were setting it up right, they had roles and they knew what their goals were. And, you know, and we could measure those goals. And it was hard. It was really hard to get that set up, to get that kind of accountability set up. But, you know, eventually we did get it with the phone banking. We got it with a few other things. So it's, you know, it is important, you know, that you know, to not get the idea that our message is, just like let everybody go do cool stuff and it'll be great. And yeah, the tyranny of the annoying is one of the, one of our rules is defeat the tyranny of the annoying. And, you know, this is a phrase that, you know, we've kind of used for a long time. And, one of the reasons why, if you don't give people clear structure and roles and have accountability, is there's this tiny minority of people. I mean, it's really just like 1 in 100 people that are just sort of determined, you know, they're just really counterproductive. They want to take over the group,
Did this come out of like the General Assemblies? It reminds me of like sort of what sometimes would derail like the General Assemblies in Occupy on some level.
But one person with their
specific agenda and everyone has to bend to it.
But it's just that's just universal. That wasn't specific to Occupy. That's in every single group.
Yeah, and when you think about it, I mean, the people that come to get to work, if they find their time is wasted because organizers are too polite to shut someone down who's brought their own agenda to a group and is taking up too much time, you know, then these disruptive people, no matter how well intentioned they are, they're hurting the movement. And so we really wanted the people that wanted to come to work and they were heads down and they were good on a team. And so that was our responsibility then when people were, you know, wasting the time of the group, you know, to be able to move those people out so that other people could continue to do good work. And I think this is something as liberals, people really feel like everybody's entitled to take up space into their own opinion. But you really have to respect volunteers and the time they're putting in. And, you know, if you have a room full of 100 people, you can't let, you know, someone, even if they just take up 5 hours talking about something that's not on the agenda, if they just take 5 minutes, you multiply that by 100 people and it's hours of wasted time.
Right.
And we just couldn't afford to let that go.
All right. I want to turn to a piece that you guys wrote I think it was Huffington Post, I believe. I'm not sure where I actually pulled this from, but it is...
Yeah, it was Huffington Post.
Okay, and I mention it just because, I mean, we're pre-taping this, but on today's program, I spent 15, 20 minutes on the phone with a guy who argued essentially what you argued in this piece, and he had lived it in Pennsylvania, which is that Hillary Clinton's get-out-the-vote operation may have turned out Trump voters. Now, his argument was that there was essentially a piece of data that existed in the partisan index, essentially, that voter files have, that was wrong as to whether or not it was predictive of them voting for Clinton. That's a rough summation, but give me the summation of your argument, Zach.
I think Becky has more to say. All right, on
Becky,
this than me,
then,
I just wanted to start though by saying that it's. Like the reason we wanted to write that was because of we wanted to point to this other way of going about things, and that there's a paradigm shift that we should really be having right now. And, you know, because of, you know, what we were just talking about how it's actually possible to mobilize enough people to identify who your supporters are, not by modeling, you know, so we got all excited about big data and modeling, but actually, we have the capacity if we can, you know, excite volunteers and give them something big to work for, to actually ask people, who are you supporting?
So Becky, what went wrong here? This big data versus big organizing, what went wrong?
Well, here we have a lot of questions, right? And so what we're doing is we're throwing out questions because obviously, you know, the Democrats lost an election that they should have won, and the implications are enormous and dangerous. And so, you know, what we've seen anecdotal evidence of and what your caller saw was that, you know, we were hearing from people who did GOTV. So they were getting out the vote, lists of voters that were supposed to be for Clinton, and they were knocking on their doors or calling them or sending them text messages on election day. And they were finding that they were reaching a lot of people who were enthusiastic Trump supporters. And, you know, there could be a few things wrong with your walk list on election day, but by the time election day comes around, these lists should be pretty much, you should only be talking to your campaign supporters, right? And people that have been identified as your campaign supporters. And so there could be, you know, like a couple mistakes every once in a while, but the numbers we were hearing from people, we thought maybe there's something wrong. And the reason why we bring this up in part is that we think that it is a symptom of a problematic attitude towards organizing that's part of how the Democratic Party runs elections. And it's this what we call a small organizing approach. And what happens with most federal elections is a candidate will hire consultants, often an expensive firm, that will take a look at the voters in the district, and they'll come up with a plan. Who are the fewest people that you can talk to and turn out to win the election? And it's often a slice of swing voters. You figure the base will turn out at a certain amount, and then you've got these swing voters, and so then you just sort of do a turnout operation on that. And the people that run the campaign really try, they don't try to talk to as many people as they can. And when election day comes, these consultants, they take the list that they've modeled, and some volunteers come in, and then they basically try and turn out everybody on the list. And you know, there's another way to do politics, and this is how we did it on the Bernie campaign, but how a lot of grassroots candidates do the work is you take a big approach to organizing, and that means you have, you know, a candidate and a message that is really resonates with the people, and so you're able to get a lot of volunteers. And those volunteers talk to as many people as they can, not as few people. And they talk to people, and they hear about their concerns, and they find out, you know, each individual voter that they reach at the door on the phone, are they for your candidate? Are they against your candidate? Do they need persuading? And then when election day comes along, you have this list of people that you've already talked to, and an influx of other volunteers come and continue this conversation and turn people out on election day. And the problem with the small organizing approach is that if you get some assumption in your model wrong, right? And we wonder if there was an assumption that was in the model that was wrong. And these models really rely heavily on party preference, and that might have been part of it. If there's assumption, then it can have disastrous results. Not even that you don't turn out some people that you should, but that you might have your volunteers turning out some of your opponent's voters. And so, and you know, if there was a feedback loop where you were regularly talking to voters, you'd be hearing back, you know, our messages are or aren't resonating, or wow, you know, we got some Trump voters, we need to look into this. I mean, and in fact, Debbie Dingell, who's the congresswoman from Ann Arbor, was, you know, actually, yes, you know, actually spoke in public and said, I was trying to tell the Clinton campaign that we were in trouble in Michigan. And, you know, there was just nowhere from this feedback from people on the ground to go that, I mean, it's not that there's nowhere, we have to wonder what happened to the feedback from people on the ground when they got it. And were they not talking to enough people to actually know what was going on? Because, you know, there certainly was enough volunteers in the state of California, you know, that in the last week before the election, that if they had been on a dialer, they could have called every single number in Michigan to recalibrate the model and see an ID who should really be turned out on election day.
And so, yeah. I mean, what is it about that? What was it about the campaign, or just, I mean, is there something ideological that runs in here, or is it? I mean, is it stuff like it's just, you know, the consultant that they get hired? There's more money in doing it a different way for them. I mean, like I'm looking at like the advertising that took place in L.A. versus Milwaukee, and there's no explanation for it other than the fact that L.A. has got a much more expensive media market, and if I'm getting 10% commission, I'm gonna buy my ads in L.A. as opposed to Milwaukee, particularly if it's just very lucrative for me to assume Milwaukee's in the bag.
Yeah, you know, that's a good, I wish people would ask the campaign that question. So why did they make these decisions? Was it because they had a hard time recruiting volunteers? You know, they never implemented a dialer for out-of-state volunteers. I don't know if they had them in the States.
That was crazy. That was
crazy.
So
I'm not sure.
That, very strange. All right, so let me ask you this. I mean, at the very least.
Well, and also.
Go ahead.
Wait, and just on that, you know, I mean, there's, you know, like, what is the expression? Wednesday morning quarterbacking?
Monday.
What is that?
Monday morning.
Monday morning quarterbacking. Okay, right. I see. Somebody was joking about Wednesday. Okay, yeah. So there's Monday morning. Yeah, so this would be Wednesday morning quarterbacking because it's the day after the election. But anyway, so there's the, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking. That's, you know, the thing is, that's what happens after a football game, because who cares about a football game? The problem is that we actually, you know, there are decisions being made right now about who's going to run the Democratic Party,
right,
about what kind of people are going to staff the Democratic Party. You know, candidates have to make decisions, you know, about what they're going to do, how they're going to build their campaigns going forward. So this is a conversation that absolutely has to happen. And, you know, it's really sad. I mean, you know, I worked on the Kerry campaign, I worked on the Dean campaign. We both worked on the Bernie campaign. We both had many losses. We know how bad it feels to lose. And we've critiqued our own losses, right after we've had them, actually. But we also know how it feels when other people critique them. It doesn't feel good. But, you know, when somebody like Donald Trump is allowed to win, and, you know, really setting our whole country in a totally different direction and a very scary direction, then we have no other choice but to, get on it right away and figure out, and this isn't about figuring out like, oh, did this person make this mistake? It's not about that at all. And that's absolutely not what we and, you know, others that are trying to figure out this stuff are talking about. It's about the philosophy and the approach to politics and organizing.
Well, this is also, I mean, it's a sort of a corollary to the tyranny of the annoying. Is that like, look, we can't afford to make this about people's feelings at this point. I mean, it's not, nobody's looking to bring anybody into the town square and put them in the stockade. But the bottom line is like, this is a major, major, major screw up with massive, horrible implications. And that's the best case scenario, it seems to me. It could even get worse than that. So this stuff is really important to get right. And it's, the fact is, the real question is there something to me, and I don't know that there's an answer, but from the ideology that made these mistakes more possible. I mean, I feel like there were decisions made by the campaign, the Clinton campaign, to go for, these suburban Republican voters that I think was misguided and impacted both their rhetoric and their lack of a message that they wanted to give to bring these other people out. I mean, you know, that's the other question is, was it absolutely necessary? I mean, was it a lack of a message that made it possible for people to knock on that door and find out that they're talking to a Trump voter? Could that person in another universe been a Clinton voter? Or was that person always a Trump voter, just a low propensity voter? I mean, just give me your opinion on that, Becky.
Well, I think, to the extent to which you have a lot of people that voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, and some of those voters voted for Trump, they were gettable voters, right? And so there's been lots of speculation about, why those voters went to Trump. And then there's also a lot of people that voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 who just didn't turn out, right? And I think we can assume on a certain level that they weren't motivated to vote, right? And it probably had a lot of factors in it, but one of it could be, that they weren't motivated, to vote for more of the same. So I think, what we saw with the Bernie Sanders campaign was that people, they heard Bernie's message and they were motivated to vote for him and to volunteer for him because they shared his political analysis about taking back power from the corporations and the 1% and having government work for the people again. And that really motivated people. We didn't have that message in the general election, or at least we didn't have it the Democrats didn't have it.
All right. So, I reached out to you for this interview, maybe over, I don't know, whatever. It was before the election. And I anticipated that we would be talking, obviously, about your book, but how the, you want to call it the Bernie Sanders wing, the Elizabeth Warren wing, the more populist, the more grassroots wing of the Democratic Party begins to push Hillary Clinton to the left and to, focus on a set of policy issues that we want to change. Obviously, that's we're in a different scenario now. I want to hear from both of you, and I know we're running out of time here, but Zach, from your perspective, what do we need to do now? Like, how do we take the tools that you're giving us here and just like more broadly speaking, how do we play defense in this situation? And I'm going to add another layer to this. I remember the aughts and the idea that I was fighting alongside people against the Bush administration who by 2009, I realized like we weren't exactly on the same side on these issues. Right. Yeah, I mean, there was a bit of a popular front. Mm-hmm. How do we maintain the integrity of the more left issue perspective, but at the same time also, you know, where do we have to do we have to make compromises to fight Donald Trump so that we're not going backwards too far?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a lot of playing defense, but we also in some really important ways, right? Like when Trump decides to actually go for, you know, deporting some number of millions of people, of our neighbors, right? But I think we have to play offense. And what, you know, what just happened, the way Trump got elected was, you know, as we've been saying, that there really wasn't a compelling vision on the other side, right? And the Clinton campaign just, you know, didn't have an answer for how Hillary Clinton was going to, or even just what her vision was to get incomes going back up again, to get job participation going up, you know, to take on mass incarceration, you know, and to deal with police violence and a whole bunch of other stuff. There was no vision there. There was just, you know, kind of empty slogans, right? And you know, to the extent that there were policy positions, it was, you know, it was stuff that was clearly, you know, just weak, compromised stuff. Like instead of free college tuition, it was make college more affordable, you know, that kind of thing. And instead of, you
and
know,
we never
okay,
heard that in the general. I mean, the fact is that it was sitting on the website, but we never heard it was never that was
right,
never
right, right.
the banner that was yeah. carried. It was just yeah. Donald Trump is a moral monster. And that's it.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, yeah. And so I think that's why that's why the Clinton campaign lost. That's what gave Trump this chance. And also part of what gave Trump his chance was, you know, yes, xenophobia, yes, racism. And also because everybody, you know, everybody to some extent on that Republican GOP stage was talking about, not everybody, but, a whole lot of those candidates on the GOP primary stage were talking in really xenophobic terms of, you know, deporting millions and millions of people. For example, they also were talking about that. Why did Trump win? It was partly because he talked about these economic issues that in very stark, specific, graphic ways, right? And he really ran far to the left of Hillary Clinton on the economy. And you know, while he didn't have a totally coherent economic vision, he painted a very graphic picture of factories being built in, you know, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan communities. He went all over those states and painted this picture over and over and over, and did fill in, you know, enough details to make it credible. So what we need to do is we need to get a vision together for the American people of a multiracial, multiethnic, feminist movement that is also talking about income and jobs, right? And we have to do that. And if we don't do that, that's not to say this is all about class. Hey, everybody, let's just talk about class. Let's stop talking about all this race and, you know, stuff. That's absolutely wrong, because that's also a path to losing and losing and losing. Right. And it's the immoral path in a society like ours. And so we really have to put a full-fledged vision for how to actually make everybody's life better, workers of all races and ethnicities and genders. And if we don't do that, we're just going to get nowhere. And if we do it and we organize around that vision, we will win. So the question is, though, you know, people that have been, you know, there's so many people in the Democratic establishment now that have kind of been lulled into this, you know, neoliberal, you know, intellectual sleep, that it's going to be hard to get people, you know, to do what I just said.
Yeah, and I think I'll just add briefly that, like, the, you know, this election, for the vote in this election, it wasn't so much an endorsement of Donald Trump as much as it was a resounding defeat for Clintonism and neoliberalism. So now we have to resist, we have to rebuild the party, but we absolutely have to offer an alternative, because if we don't, we're never going to get out of this hole we've dug for ourselves.
I mean, that was a lot better. Use Becky's clip instead of my monologue.
Well, but Becky, how do we? I mean. How do we keep both those tracks going? I mean, how do we avoid how do we keep the argument between those two different visions for America from inhibiting our ability to stop Donald Trump going forward?
Look, I think that there's a tremendous capacity in the grassroots to do the work necessary to change this country. And we can see it right now. People are just bursting out of their workplaces and their schools and into the streets. And they're marching because that's what people are around them are doing and what they're being asked to do. But if we ask them to get to work to, you know, overwhelm the 2018 elections and sweep in a new kind of candidate with a message that's, that addresses structural racism as well as economic inequality, that addresses climate as well as immigration reform, and brings, you know, working class people of color and working class whites together under a vision that's going to actually sort of fix some of these problems that are just so deeply broken in America, I think we can win. It's going to be hard work, and we have to start immediately. And there's plenty of energy to do that while we, you know, try to oppose the worst abuses of the Trump administration. We simply have to do it all. But the good news is that if we actually invite the people to be part of these campaigns, we're gonna have the capacity to do everything we need to do.
Becky Bond, Zach Exley. The book is Rules for Revolutionaries: How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate your time today. And the book is great, and it's a great resource. And, you know, good for you guys for giving it away for far less than consultants tend to charge for these things. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. It's
like, we need shows like yours more than ever, and we're just happy to get to contribute to the kind of the work that you do, you know, every day, educating people and starting a conversation. And so we're happy to be part of that conversation with you.
Well, thank you again. I appreciate it. Thanks again to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tapes, a brand new amazing podcast, for sponsoring today's episode. Secret Crimes and Audio Tape is an audio drama told week after week. Features stories about crime, love, mystery, or conspiracy with actors you know and love. Some are dramas, some are comedies. Make sure you don't miss a single episode. Subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever or however you listen to podcasts. To get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there.